Hello and welcome to the MMQB Monday Morning NFL Podcast. I'm your host, Gary Gramling. I'm going to be joined by a special guest in just a moment. We are rolling through. Really, it's I am. It's my show. The other guy's a special guest. I am rolling through the division previews. We are on to the AFC East, and with that, we bring on the aforementioned special guest. It's Andy Benoit.
These intros are getting a little carried away.
I don't know. Do we build it up now?
It's not special anymore, for one. I've been doing it every Monday.
Oh, it is special. Okay, but go on.
I don't think you need to veil it like you do.
Maybe, but one day you'll be gone and we'll have a new guest and we'll have to veil that, and I don't know. People will probably be disappointed, but
well, they get disappointed when you say it's special and then it's the same guy every single week.
No, I think they're not disappointed. I think you are special, and I think you should embrace it, and I think we should celebrate it. And I think we should have that same build-up every week. And I really feel, when I listen to the show on Monday morning, I can feel the anticipation. Sometimes I'm even not sure who I'm going to introduce, and then it's you, and then I'm really happy about it.
All right. Your show.
You're also, I should mention, Andy's in a very warm room right now. So I think this is going to be like a 3-minute show so we can get back into the air conditioning. We are on the AFC East. As always, we are going to go order of standing from last season. However, at the end of the show, we will make our projections for the 2020 standings. But we are starting with the New England Patriots, the defending, I don't know, 85-time division champions here. Okay, so the big news this week, Dante Hightower is going to opt out for the season, as is Patrick Chung, a couple other guys as well, Marcus Cannon on the other side of the ball. But this linebacking core specifically, Andy, it's now no Kyle Van Noy, no Jamie Collins. They signed with other teams, and now no Hightower. What does this do with their ability to basically function in the front seven?
Yeah, if we didn't know this team, if you remove the uniforms, you look at this, you say this is one of the three or four least talented front sevens in the NFL, I would imagine. I don't know. And the way they play in New England, we've talked about, it's a little bit different, where brawn over athleticism, it does kind of lean that way a little bit. But I don't see how this isn't a 6-10 type of team right now, and yet I feel so out of place forecasting anything like that, or not forecasting, but seeing the Patriots in that kind of light. It's just hard to get past all the history we've seen with them. But they're basically, if this Cam Newton thing goes through and that's how they play, you know, I think that decision was probably largely with the defense in mind. We'll play to our defense. I don't know if they've got that kind of defense to play towards now.
Yeah, I mean, the secondary is still really good. Obviously, you have Gilmore, you have Devin McCourty back there. It's a deep unit. It's a good unit. They always, you know, even beyond those stars, they seem to play beyond the sum of their parts. But it's really difficult. I mean, one, where's the pass rush coming from? I guess you hope Chase Winovich takes a jump here. Josh Uche, another Michigan guy they drafted this year, pure speed rusher. Maybe it generates something there, but it's always been, I don't want to put too much emphasis on, okay, well, what's a run defense going to be? That's obviously a secondary concern for every defense in the league right now, but you do kind of look at it and it's like, I don't know, you take for granted so many years that they're just going to effectively stop the run, and they're going to get in teams in a lot of third and medium, third and long, and they're going to get off the field that way. I don't know. I don't know about this unit. Well, Lawrence Guy is really good. I'm not sure who else I see up there that is really good.
Well, and one of the advantages, Chung, I would consider part of their run defense very much so. He's a slot corner, but he's not a slot corner, he's a safety, but he plays a lot of slot corner. He really plays a lot of linebacker for him. Mm-hmm. When you can play your pass defense and feel good about how you match up against the run, when you have the best of both worlds, in other words, when you can stop the run out of nickel, is basically what we're getting at, and Patrick Chung gave him the ability to stop the run out of nickel, I think that makes the coaching staff extremely comfortable. And so now you're talking about, okay, we're not as good against the run, but that comfort might also get sacrificed as well. Now, and maybe we ought to also consider New England is probably equipped to live without Chung just because they're so deep at safety. They have Adrian Phillips now. They drafted Kyle Duggar in the second round this year. I don't know if they view him as someone ready to play or not. I guess it's not overly deep, but as Jawan Williams from last year in the second round, maybe they can find the replacement for Chung. There's no replacement for Hightower. And the fact that Kyle Van Noy and Jamie Collins are gone, basically the best four of the five best players up front from last year. Lawrence Guy is the only one back. The other four, Chung, Hightower, Collins, and Van Noy, they're all gone. And now we find out for real how much of it's the system and how much of it's the players and finding the type of players that fit the system, because I assume that the backups are guys that also fit the system in Bill Belichick's mind. It'll be interesting to see how it shapes out that way. It's a great experiment and test on a coaching mm-hmm. staff that we've really put on a pedestal for good reason over the years.
Yeah, and obviously limited offseason, all that stuff that we talk about all the time. There's a ton of changeover for that. On top of that, look at 7 defensive touchdowns last year. That was probably not going to be replicated anyway.
And some of that's overblown. You know, they scooped up some fumbles that just bounced the right way. They had a couple of tip balls at the end of a Dolphins blowout that, you know, it's. But I hear what you're saying.
I do want to talk on the offense side of the ball. And, you know, we devoted a show to Cam Newton a couple weeks ago, and I don't think a whole lot has changed on that front since. Marcus Cannon is gone, but that's not going to change fundamentally what they do, even if you're downgrading the right tackle spot. One guy we didn't really talk a whole lot about on that show that I was just kind of curious about, where does James White? I mean, he was so effective moving around, you know, when it was Tom Brady's offense. Where does a James White fit in a Cam Newton offense?
Yeah, that's a great question, because really the value of James White is he's an outstanding underneath weapon, especially in the flats and a well-designed quick strike passing game. And the Patriots do a great job of leveraging him especially on the weak side of the formation, it feels like, and leveraging him with other routes, and they get these combination routes underneath. And we've talked about how Cam Newton probably doesn't quite fit that style of play. If you are going to drop back with Newton, you're going to throw the ball further downfield. You're probably going to use a little bit more play action, which that's New England's prepared to do all those things. They've done these in recent years. They'll emphasize it more. But your running back becomes more part of the pass protection first, and then he's a check down weapon in the passing game, which is very different, because not only is he getting fewer touches as a receiver, but defenses are preparing for him differently now as well. And last season, it was evident every single week, by December, every week, it was Julian Edelman got the double teams and James White got the double teams, and nobody else got any attention from a defense on that Patriot offense. Well, now that you're not doubling White, that's going to emphasize the lack of weapons at wide receiver, potential lack of weapons at wide receiver, even more, because there's just one less weapon underneath now. Assuming that they are playing the full-fledged Cam Newton style of football. Maybe they feel they can do some of their stuff with White anyway. We'll find out. I know one thing that does come to mind, Gary, off the top of my head, if you want to make life easier on Newton, and I think you're going to have to do that because of the lack of weapons around him, if you want to do that, playing with two running backs might help serve that to some degree. Yeah. Just because it's an unusual package. So if you have White and Burkhead out there together, and I thought we'd see that a lot more last year, and we saw it a lot in, I want to say it's week one that we saw it, and then it never quite stuck. But if you had those guys out there together, you know, maybe you do something creative that way. The problem is more teams have started doing that offensively, and defenses have figured out we're just going to play nickel against it, because that second running back is essentially the same as a third receiver for how these plays shake out. So I don't know. Do you have something?
No, I was just to say, we also, I should mention, Dan Vitale, the fullback they added, has also opted out at this point. And, you know, obviously this is a team that used the fullback more than most, but you wonder if Vitale might have had an even more significant role than we expected as they sort of go through this offensive transition.
Yes, because remember Mike Tolbert for the Panthers when Cam Newton was really rolling with them? You know, and Vitale's not the same player as Tolbert, and Tolbert was a pretty good ball handler at times. But the point is that fullback, when you have a fullback as a second running back instead of another tailback, then you do get base personnel always, mm-hmm. especially if you have a running QB like Cam Newton. So they're going to want to play with that fullback and make it a numbers and angles game with their rushing attack. So they have to find a replacement. Vital is a good player, and what he's a good player for what they were going to ask him to do, because what he started doing in Green Bay last year is flexing out of the formation. I think it was the Raiders game in Week 7 where that really took on a prominence, and he showed that he can run some vertical routes out of the fullback position, which is those are extremely hard to defend because most coverages are not set up to account for those. So the dimension that you get at the fullback position, Vital is probably a more dynamic receiving threat, he certainly is, than James Devlin was. And a big part of the Patriots offense in recent years has been the ability to flex into passing formations when Devlin's on the field. That's just how creative and versatile the passing attack is. Vital would have been a weapon there. They'll still do all these things just with a lesser guy. Last year it was Jacob Johnson. Maybe that's who they go with again. But it's not going to be. They're not going to feed the fullback the ball the way they maybe would have.
Okay. All right. In a few minutes, we will be projecting the New England Patriots placement in this 2020 season. But let's go on to last year's second place team in this division, wild card team, the Buffalo Bills. Andy, I'm going to, I didn't really line it up this way, but I am going to start with like a 20-minute monologue here on the Bills, and I'm going to throw a bunch of numbers at you before I get to my question.
Okay.
So Josh Allen's a rookie. Passes inside 20 yards through the air. So behind the line of scrimmage out to 20 yards through the air, 59.7%. They add Cole Beasley. Beasley ended up catching, this is something like, 660. Right around 66% of those passes that were thrown to Cole Beasley last year were completed. Allen's numbers on those throws, those shorter throws, 20 yards and in, that's a wide range, but it's Josh Allen. They jumped from 59.7 to 66.3 completion percentage in year two. Now, they've added Stephon Diggs. I think a very underrated part of Stephon Diggs' game is his ball tracking ability downfield. And it's something I kind of noticed last year because I thought he was misjudging balls and then correcting himself, but I think he's kind of baiting. Kirk Cousins would sort of throw those high arcing deep balls, and he'd sort of, bait a defensive back to sort of judge what he was doing and sort of, basically get out of trajectory with the ball. Out of trajectory, how about that for a term?
Mm-hmm.
But really, he was just, he's creating late separation. He ends up getting the ball, ends up getting the big play. So Stephon Diggs last year, 30 passes thrown to him that traveled at least 20 yards in the air. He caught 53% of them. That was Josh Allen's weak spot. And we all know about Josh Allen's arm strength. Somebody talked about it once. But Josh Allen, downfield throws over 20 yards, 20.9% last year completion percentage, which was even worse than his rookie year, which is 23.7, which is still really bad. League average is right around 35%. But like I said, Diggs was one of the best last year, 53%. I'm wondering, how much does Stephon Diggs sort of mesh with Josh Allen as a downfield thrower? Because the other thing about Josh Allen, I just mentioned what I liked about Diggs on some of these sort of high-arcing rainbow throws downfield. Josh Allen tends to throw a fairly flat deep ball from my judgment. There's not a whole lot of air under it because he doesn't have to throw a fastball downfield. Am I right to be optimistic about Diggs? Diggs obviously helps, but does Diggs lead to a kind of breakout where all of a sudden he's like a league average downfield passer?
It's a great question. I think Diggs, of course, helps. You can probably say Diggs is a true number one receiver. Buffalo certainly sees him that way. And this offense, he'll be viewed that way by defenses because, John Brown's probably their number two, and there's a pretty big gap between the threat that those guys pose. Diggs is a more dynamic, scarier receiver than John Brown. a lot of what Allen's deep ball struggles with, I mean, he needs to get better at it for sure, and especially because I do think that's has to be a strength of his game. Those guys that are these big arm, big bodied, late in the down throwers, the Carson Wentz, a former Andrew Luck type, you can't be glaringly weak at the vertical ball just because, even though that's not everything, you're going to throw three or four of those every game. I think a lot of Allen's problems on some of those throws is that he's not quite crisp at reading safeties just yet. And it was more apparent early last season than late, which is a great sign. And it was certainly more apparent in his rookie year than it was in his sophomore season. But there are times you can tell, because a lot of these deep balls come on designer shots where it's you're calling the play to take the shot, which means that you're reading the safety and the route combination. It's usually not a combo. It's just one over here, one over there. Whatever it is, you're trying to beat the safety, the center field safety. And Allen, at times you can tell, predetermines what he's going to do with the ball rather than read that center field safety or read a corner who might carry with someone or whatever it is. So he makes some bad decisions on deep balls, and that's going to lead to incompletions. If that can get cleaned up, and I think it can, for the reason that, one, it's his third season now, but two, with Diggs, the safeties will be a little bit more predictable because they're going to cheat towards Diggs. So at least you know what you're getting at times. Maybe that will help Allen as well. Maybe some of those deep balls connect where they weren't before. Does that answer your question? I know it wasn't an only deep ball question, but it was like 3 days ago that we started talking about it, and I'm trying to remember exactly what the thesis was.
Yeah, I mean, all I can really think about right now is how wonderful Western New York is. But I guess my overall question, Andy, is I think you saw a more confident quarterback throwing in those short intermediate range passes after you added Cole Beasley last year, a guy who can, a guy who thrives on those kinds of routes. I'm wondering if you see a similar jump with Diggs coming in, because, you know, again, it's a vague concept that I'm throwing at you, but that's what I do, and then you correct me or do your thing. But do you basically have a more confident deep ball thrower in Josh Allen, and therefore more effective, more efficient?
Probably, I think, because that'll be symptomatic of if he's more confident overall. It's just a product of how he is handling the entire game. And the Bills did a nice job of using their formationing and the way they aligned Beasley to make life easier and to capitalize on Beasley, who is, I think, maybe the best underneath one-on-one separator in football. And he's not just that, by the way. They'll use him on vertical concepts. They're not going to necessarily run him on a go route, but they'll use him on fades and sail type of routes out of the slot. So they've done a nice job of diversifying the offense with it. Diggs will only add to that, certainly. And I would imagine the whole intent of all of it is going to be to get Josh Allen as comfortable as possible, because the issue is not, he'll probably always miss a few throws because he's a bit of a wild stallion type of thrower. But the issue is not him throwing physically. It's how he's interpreting the game mentally. And then sometimes that gets into how the ball comes out. If you can get him comfortable with everything that he's seeing, you're going to get the most out of his throwing talent, and then maybe then you start looking at trying to clean up some of the mechanical issues. Again, I think those are just always going to be something you live with. Mm-hmm. So the more comfortable he can get, and a lot of that anymore comes out of the pre-snap phase. That's basically how football is played. And with Josh Allen, because you want him to be, I don't know, do you want him to be a playmaker? I'm asking that question because I do think some of his negative plays comes when he tries to do too much. I would love to know if the Bills want him to be, I mean, everybody's going to say, yeah, we want our guy to be a playmaker, yeah, but I would love to know how they really feel about that.
I lean towards yes. I know a lot of people, I mean, look, our last image of him was running down the field and throwing a desperate lateral at an inappropriate time in a playoff game when they're trying to get back into it. I don't think he was overly reckless. I didn't think he needed to be really reined in. I thought he got out of control in that specific playoff game, but I don't think it was like an issue plaguing him throughout the season.
No, it wasn't. Some of his plays, he did have, I mean, that lateral was not the only play where he just lost his mind for a few seconds and happened to have the ball in his hand. There was an interception, I remember, against Cincinnati that was maybe the worst in the league decision-wise all year. He's done some of those in the red zone before. He's a young quarterback, and he's talented, and I get all that. So I would love to know how you, if you're Buffalo, how do you try to channel or regulate that? Are you going to just... Do you think it's important enough to regulate it with your system, where you're trying to make it so he is not in position to make those dumb decisions, or do you believe in him at this point enough to say, Josh, you can't have that. You can't ever have that. You got to be smarter in that and hope that works with them. Different guys, it's different answers to that. But what I'm getting at, Gary, is I think he's a half field reader at this point. And that'll make it most comfortable for him and allow him to play looser. And I think that's a good thing with the Bills. Some QBs, you need to make them tighter. Allen, you probably is a guy you want him to play a little bit looser and let him be more of an athlete.
Okay. I lean towards the latter. I think you don't over-regulate him. I think you lean in that direction with Josh Allen, if you're going to have Josh Allen as your quarterback.
I can see why you'd say that, but just to clarify to people, because it might sound like we're not really saying anything at all. Patrick Mahomes, you lean in the direction of whatever Mahomes wants to do, he's going to do, and we'll live with it. If he throws 10 picks a year, and by the way, he didn't have a lot last year, but he's going to throw a couple bad ones every year. We'll live. It's the cost of doing business. We live with that. Nobody has to have that explained to them. Brett Favre was that way. I don't know if Allen's quite that kind of player or not, because what he has that Mahomes doesn't are very specific limitations in certain areas as a passer. And then the question basically is, can we work around those limitations, or can he plow through them? Which do you want? And I think that gets in at the heart of how much you just let him be him or let him go. I don't think he's a blank canvas guy at this point, though. I don't think there are very many blank canvas QBs. Mm-hmm. But I don't think he's a mature enough QB at this point to be that. That doesn't mean he's not a quality starter. He's very much a young QB, though.
Yeah. See, I think you just go forward, because it also gives you an idea of who he is and who he's going to become over the next, five seasons here for the Bills. And they'll eventually have a decision to make on him.
I think that's fair, but, it's all good and well to find out who he is, but we're the best team talent-wise in the AFC East right now. That window has not been open for us in a long time. We should have probably won our wild card playoff game last year. We have a great defense. We have weapons all over the offense, or no weaknesses anyway. If you're Buffalo, you ought to feel it's a Super Bowl-type season. It might not be Super Bowl or bust, but that's the goal, certainly, is Super Bowl. So I don't know if you want to be feeling out Josh Allen, figure out what we have in him. You need to have the best version of him right now. This is what you have him for. You're trying to win a Super Bowl.
He's a wild card. Let him be a wild card, Andy.
Yeah. The coaches will get home earlier if that's the plan. Maybe they'll want to do it. The more I think about it and work our way through this and kind of say everything and nothing at the same time, the more interested I become in Josh Allen. He's an interesting guy.
I feel like you're on the verge of saying you want to rein him in. It's certainly much more than I do, but we'll see whose imaginary team does better in the various multiverses. I don't know how we'll figure it out.
Well, if you eliminated some of the wide-eyed plays that he has and the handful of bonehead mistakes, which I do think will get eliminated, is he a different quarterback then? And then what does he become? Do you have to get some of that cleaned up? Do you have to kind of just get him on the right path just a little bit and then let him go? It sounds like you're kind of saying just let him go. No training wheels. If he skins his knee, skins his knee.
I love the chaos of it.
Yeah.
I love that. No, I was going to say, I loved that completely out of control performance in the fourth quarter in Houston last year. It was entertaining.
Well, one thing they did in that game, and I think it does need to be a staple, and they really settled on this well in the second half of last season, is feature him in the run game. And that could be a solution to a lot of what we're talking about, because what we're trying to figure out is how do you get a guy mentally comfortable. And maybe football feels different when he runs the ball, because that one you can just let him go. Josh Dutry, here's how the play is designed, but we're not going to we're not going to kill you if you do your own thing on some of these run plays. You're fine with that. So maybe he gets five or six design carries in the first half, and now he's a more comfortable QB in the second half because you've gotten hit a little. It's a proactiveness. You're just playing. That's possible. I don't know. I would love to hear these the Bills. I guarantee you're sitting around having these discussions, and you probably have to know Josh Allen personally to really have a good sense of it.
I'm glad we're devoting a true 40 minutes to the Bills here. Other side of the ball for them, I just wanted to ask you real quick, and this one will be quicker. I mean, look, everyone sort of has circled number two cornerback as the sort of weakness in the secondary. It's been such a good secondary the last couple of years. They've been better than the sum of their parts. They've been fine with Levi Wallace out there. It might be Josh Norman this year opposite to Tre'Davious White. Is it really much of a problem spot? And specifically, if it is Norman, what do we make of Norman at this point? I mean, obviously, he was such a name brand guy a couple of years ago. He's not that anymore, but are we kind of exaggerating his downfall based on the fact that he was so good?
Possibly. He just doesn't run very well. And so what do you do about that? Now, Buffalo plays a lot of zone, but most zone schemes, the cornerbacks still have what amount to a form of man-to-man on the outside, one-on-one man coverage. They're very interchangeable with their safeties in Buffalo. They're not crazy schematic. Like, they don't do stuff that's hard to read once the coverage settles. They don't have a bunch of crazy coverages like the Chiefs have or some of these matchup zone teams, the Broncos and the Bears. They have very basic coverages. They just get to them in untraditional ways, and they create this illusion of complexity. So you can hide Josh Norman a little bit or give him some help if you feel you need to do that. Remember in Washington, Gary, there's always the talk about, oh, Norman's not traveling with anyone. Why isn't Norman traveling? I bet he'll be traveling this year because he's going to travel with whoever Tre'Davious White is not traveling with. Yeah. He's going to be the number two guy. And Levi Wallace is not a bad player. So if you fall back on Wallace and that has to be the way it goes, I think there's a good chance that will be the way it goes. This isn't the end of the world. Their number two cornerback spot can only be better this year than it was last year, assuming these guys stay healthy. And last year they got through it just fine. It wasn't an issue.
Yep. Levi Wallace, by the way, Connor Orr favorite.
Connor Orr doesn't remember that.
No, and the backstory, I'll give everyone the backstory really quick. Andy and Connor did it was basically like a test podcast. You guys were building an expansion team, and you were basically it was just discussing a lot of players that you guys like or don't like or whatever it ends up being. Levi Wallace came up. According to Andy, Connor professed his love for Levi Wallace. According to Connor, he has no idea what Andy's talking about. He doesn't remember even mentioning Levi Wallace. And no one else has heard the tape. So and I never want to, because I just want this mystery to exist. Tell me on my deathbed, but I don't want to know before that.
I already told you, Connor professed his love for Levi Wallace.
Okay. And Connor says no. Connor says he's never heard of the man. So
I'm very confident in what he said about Levi Wallace, because I remember thinking, oh, I bet there's no way Connor likes, I view myself like, oh, I'm one of the guys that appreciates Levi Wallace. That's how much I watch film, which I that's true. I do feel that way. And then when Connor gave his thoughts on Wallace, I thought, well, I can't compete with it. I don't think Wallace is the next Deion Sanders, the way Connor's making this sound. Connor definitely said that. One other thing on this.
I just want to say, I can't wait to die so I find out the answer for it, but I want to stay in suspense until then.
One other thing about this Bills secondary, because Tre'Davious White is a true number one corner. Did he get the first team All-Pro nod? I know he got a lot of votes. He's had that kind of season.
That's a good question. I'll look it up. You go.
Yeah, I don't. You'll tell me. But I mean, he's in that category. He's top five, top 10 NFL corner for sure. Man and zone. I would still argue that the most important part of the secondary is the interchangeability of the safety zone. Yeah. Jordan Poyer and Micah Hyde, in some respects, they're probably the best 1-2 safety tandem in football. Harrison Smith and Harris in Minnesota, you can make an argument for those guys as well, but a lot of what Buffalo does just hinges on how creative and really smart before the snap those safeties are. It's probably the best interchangeable safety duo in the NFL.
And Tre'Davious White was Associated Press All-Pro first team. He was also PFW, PFWA, All-NFL team. So he made it all.
They're good. By the way, we ought to mention now, Ryan Taylor did indeed do that Associated Press study from last week.
Yeah, yep.
Looking at, and I think the average number of primetime games for a guy who got the MVP award and Defensive Player of the Year was both slightly over four. Because I'm always kind of saying, you know, voters are going to cheat towards the guys that are on TV the most. I don't know if that's conclusive. I don't know what I was expecting it to be, because the average won't be five, because that's the max, and only three or four teams every year have five primetime games. The average is a little bit over four, but for the defensive rookie of the year and kind of those ancillary awards, the primetime games didn't factor a whole lot. So maybe my theory about primetime voter bias, maybe that's unfounded. And the reason that the MVPs have so many primetime games is because the good teams are on primetime and you're the MVP, and the good teams' best players usually gets the MVP. They're not going to give it to the guy on a 5-11 team very often. So anyway, I think I need to back off of my voter type of theory thing.
Maybe, or I would say you just have to tweak your theory and make it a... I think you have to look at the national 4:30 game and then the Sunday night game. And then
you have to include that. Okay.
Yeah.
Any more, though, those... It used to be like most of the NFL took place at 1 o'clock Eastern time on Sundays, and then you had a couple special games. They're now, with the Thursday game and the emphasis on the 4:30 game, there are almost four primetime slots: Monday night, Sunday night, Thursday night, Sunday late afternoon, and then just one everything else slot. It's almost like we ought to just say it's what would be the opposite of primetime, but still positive? Downtime? That's not positive.
Downtime isn't positive at all. Prime-ish time?
I don't know. But the 1 o'clock games are like, that's barely half the games anymore, it feels like.
Yeah.
So if you count 4:30 games, I don't know what to do about that. You got to go by the broad. You can't, it's broadcasted. How is it broadcasted? Because if you're playing it, well, I guess if you're the number two game on like CBS, like it's a doubleheader, you don't start at 4:30, you start at 4:05. So never mind.
Yeah, I mean, the Wasteland is the regional 4 o'clock games that nobody sees. But
I usually watch those.
Yeah, well, we watch them all. But
No, you know, I don't do that on Sundays.
I guess you don't usually do the national game, do you? We usually had put you on some weird game. No.
Yeah.
That ended with a whimper, literally. Let's go on to the Jets. As the biggest Adam Gase apologist in the world, I will point out that Adam Gase, in his career as a head coach, is 20-17 when he has his first string quarterback in the lineup, and that's with two bottom 10 easily rosters. But again, he looked he had a weird look on his face at this press conference. So.
Doesn't know football now because
I do want to ask you, though. I mean, look, it's a receiving core. The offensive line is better. The receiving core, you look at it, it's like, okay, these are Jameson Crowder, Rashad Perriman, nice complementary players to each other. I do wonder if Chris Herndon's in for a big breakout here. Gase, you know, he loves to have those tight ends. Was without Herndon a year ago. How do you think he does manufacture this passing attack for Sam Darnold in year three now?
I think a lot of it, he's just counting on Darnold to make better decisions. The Josh Allen conversation we had applies to Darnold, and then just multiply it by three or four. And Darnold has a real problem with being reckless and trying to do too much. And then the other thing is he'll get snake bit at times. We saw that in the Patriot Monday night game, seeing ghosts, which that was taken out of context. But the concept of just, you know, those cover zero blitzes that night got in his head, and it snowballed from there. And that's happened a couple times with Darnold as well. He has to get better when the play goes wrong initially. He right now becomes too much of a wild card, to use your term, when the play does not start out the way that he's expecting. And experience, I think, will solve some of that. Mm-hmm. Interactions with Gase more will help. And the one thing about about Gase is he's been doing Zoom meetings for years. That's his preferred method of communication. So I'm sure this offseason hasn't felt as different to Darnold as it has to some guys. I imagine those guys have been on the internet quite a bit together. I think they're excited to work with each other because I think Darnold realizes how much better he can be. When Darnold's not making the boneheaded plays, you see the talent right there. It's just there's too many boneheaded plays right now to make a good evaluation of the guy, though.
Yeah. Defensively, and look, we talked before the Jamal Adams trade had happened when he was on the market. What is he worth? What did they get for him? What is he worth to the Jets? And you've kind of you said over the past couple months, it's not a crucial position for the Jets. You don't need a big time safety in Greg Williams' defense here. So look, the fact that they ended up getting two first round picks for him and a little bit more ended up being quite the haul for the Jets there. Well, obviously we'll talk about Adams' impact in Seattle on our NFC West show coming up sometime between now and the season, but. The pieces they have in the secondary now, they added Pierre Desir and they got Bradley McDougald in that Jamal Adams trade. Does this fit together properly? I mean, Desir is a very specific kind of cornerback, and McDougald, he's a starting caliber safety, obviously not of Jamal Adams' ability, but does it add up to something that makes sense here?
McDougald is absolutely a quality starting safety in the NFL. No, there's no question about that. Pierre Desir, long arm, strong, physical guy. When it's going well, he looks like a shutdown corner at times. When it's going poorly, you think, how can I? You know, he's just not quick or twitchy enough. And how can he be on the field? That's what you have. I think they feel because they play so much cover two, and in cover two, you're going to jam the receiver at the snap. They feel that long physicality at corner is really going to serve Desir well. Now, the Colts played a lot of cover two as well, and that's the team that just got rid of Desir because Desir was so inconsistent in the second half of last season. So a wild card, we got to get a new term there. You got me on that wild card phrase. But
yeah.
he's a joker. That help? A joker card? He can be anything. You don't know what he's going to know. He needs to be steady.
Take the jokers out of the deck, Andy. Take the joker out of the deck.
Yeah, I thought that always made the games boring as a kid. It was about adding jokers when you're 8, which is the last time I played cards regularly. Desir, a lot rides on him, though, because they are not very deep at corner. They know that. They're willing to live with that. I see here the other guy they got is Quincy Wilson from Indianapolis, who's like Desir, just even more negative, though. I think Wilson's a second-round pick, wasn't he? He was pretty...
Yeah,
he was 46 overall. Nope, 46. Yep, 46 overall in 2017. Long-arm guy, also matched up to tight ends at times. So they have these big physical defensive backs, which tells you they're counting on sticking with that cover two stuff, which is why I'm sure they're comfortable trading Adams. They got a good return on him. I didn't think that trade was as lopsided as people made it out to be, by the way.
I don't think it's – I mean, look, it's not lopsided.
I don't think it's lopsided at all. It was great.
Yeah, but both teams got what they were after. I was just surprised they got that price for him. And number one, I'm surprised we did see another trade where someone a non-quarterback went for two ones. A non-quarterback and, like, a non-Aaron Donald went for two first-round picks. But, I mean, look, Jamal Adams just – lit the entire Jets headquarters on fire. You figure that would have hurt his trade value, and instead they kind of got what I think most people saw as a maximum return for him.
Well, look at some of these teams that are making the trades for these multiple first-rounders. The Rams did it for Jalen Ramsey. The Rams view themselves as perennial contenders, I'm sure.
Yep.
The Texans did it for Laremy Tunsil, and as much as we like to, and I don't say we because I have not been part of this at all, but as much as people like to mock Bill O'Brien as general manager and all that, you know, the Texans have been in the AFC South and have won it a lot under O'Brien. I mean, they're almost a perennial playoff team under Bill O'Brien, even though they've really only had Deshaun Watson available to them for one or two late season runs now. So I'm sure they view themselves as contenders. It's when you're trading what you believe to be a late first round pick, which Seattle believes, I'm sure that they're not going to pick any higher than 25 this year. You know, they could, but they don't believe that about themselves. And trading the number 25 pick in your mind or whatever it is to go up and get a guy who was drafted 6th overall and probably would be drafted that right now if we were to ever redraft the league and bring all those guys from 2018 or 17 back into the NFL, they would have had to trade up to get Adams on draft day. So that you're basically trading up to get Jamal Adams. And what's different here is you're paying the premium because you have to give him a second contract, but you also have a sure thing. There's no guesswork in this trade. You know Jamal Adams is a star in the NFL. He's not going to be a bust the way a third of the first rounders at least become. So it's just a matter of philosophy at this point. It's not like anyone's getting fleeced. That's not happening here. John Schneider just believes that we're happy to pay a premium for a player that we think can probably have a domino effect for us that we would have had to trade up to get a guy of his draft caliber anyway, like that.
God, save it for the NFC West preview, Andy.
Yeah, you're right, because that was more of a Seahawks side of it. But the Jets, I understand why they did it. Because Jamal Adams he became a locker room cancer towards the end. It looked like it worked out for him. He got out of town. But I see why they did it as well. They got good value on their end. Win-wins are possible with trades.
Yes.
Who won the trade? They both won the trade. That happens a lot more in the NFL than people ever give credit for.
I agree. I didn't mean to set you off. I agree with you, Andy.
Okay.
Let's go to Miami to wrap this up before our projections. Chan Gailey's back. First time back in the league since 2016 with the Jets. Why has this Ryan Fitzpatrick-Chan Gailey marriage made sense in the past?
Because that's who they had. That's who the quarterback was, and that's who the coach was. I don't know if they set out to...
No one was trying to. I mean, the Jets reunited the dynamic duo. They started in Buffalo in the early 2010s, and then the Jets brought it back, and now here's Miami again, at least for the first part of the season.
Fitzpatrick is extremely decisive. When you spread out and throw the ball, sometimes that's going to work very well. That can get taken away after a while, and then what does Fitzpatrick become? Can we call him a wild card and make it 4-for-4?
Yeah,
on these
everyone's
teams?
Everyone's a wild card. No Patriots were wild cards, but we had three wild cards here.
Fitzpatrick. I'm surprised we're even talking about him because I don't think that's the plan at quarterback.
No, but it's worked so well. All right, well, let's talk about Tua then. From what you know about Tua's skill set, does it?
Is he the next
Ryan Fitzpatrick?
Fitzpatrick, I mean, I don't know how well you'd say it's worked. Chan Gailey was out of the league for a few years, and probably it was a retirement. Mm-hmm. That's not like he didn't have a job. But you know, Chan Gailey has not been mistaken for Kyle Shanahan the last few years. And, oh, my gosh, where's Chan Gailey? And Ryan Fitzpatrick's the most journeyish journeyman in the history of the NFL. So I take some issue with the premise.
But it works so beautifully. All right, let's talk about Tua and whether Tua can be as good as Ryan Fitzpatrick here. Tua skill set wise, from what you know about him, does Gailey run that same spread offense here? I guess so. On top of Tua, I mean, the fact that it's probably a team that wants to run the ball here, and you know, they bring in Jordan Howard. Does this all mesh? Do you think it's going to be that sort of spread look? And because if you can do the spread look, you're going to have a tough time sort of marrying that that run game and pass game there.
Yeah, you will. If they're spreading out, Matt Breida would make more sense at running back than Jordan Howard, and I imagine that's what they would do. Mm-hmm. Howard's a tight formation, base down type of back. You can run him out of 11 personnel, but you're not. It's going to be base personnel runs that happen to have three wide receivers on the field. I think Howard's here because, you know, Kalen Ballage, I don't mean to be harsh on him. He had, on paper, he had the worst season of best about any running back to ever play the game. I mean, his numbers were atrocious. And he didn't look good on film either, as you would imagine. They just needed to upgrade at running back. And Howard was who was available, and Breed is a different type of runner. So you'd like to have two runners that complement each other. And that's what it is. I don't know if they made go out and get either of those guys with the idea of we're going to become this or that on offense. I think they just needed different players at that position.
Okay. Well, how about Tua then? Let's get to Tua. That's all anyone wants to hear.
What was interesting last year with the Dolphins, they had – so I think Tua's a guy, and I have not watched him closely at all, but we were talking about types and style of QB. My sense is he's the type of guy that he's going to have to work well with the system, and the system's going to have to help him. And once you get that in place, he can achieve more with that system than other guys might be able to achieve with that system. But Tua in and of himself, you know, he's not Patrick Mahomes. He's not the creator – he's not that kind of athlete. There'll be comparisons to insert any mobile QB, but he's really not a dynamic mobile QB. He wasn't at Alabama. He'll move fine, but he's not gonna leave people in the dust the way certainly Lamar, but even the way a Josh Allen would. And his arm is he's not dripping with arm talent either. So what you have is intangibles, football IQ, system has to play to his strengths. And now we're talking about how are you designing and presenting your passing game, your route concepts. How are your receivers lining up? What is that continuity like? And really, once the play unfolds, I get reminded of this every so often by people within the NFL. Everybody runs the same plays in the NFL. It's just a matter of how you present them and get to them. And that's really where your system exists to some degree, of course. I'm not, you know, don't go overly literal with that, but that's the idea. What was interesting in Miami last year is they had Chad O'Shea, offensive coordinator. So people like me said, okay, well, it's going to be the Patriots stuff then. Brian Flores is here. We're trying to become the new Patriots down in the Southeast. And the Dolphins didn't play that way offensively. They didn't do the motion and the stack releases. They didn't do the quick crossing routes or option routes. That wasn't their style. And the reason for that is because their wide receivers are not those style of receivers. Devontae Parker is a long, high-cut body guy. So is Preston Williams, who was their best receiver for a lot of last year. Mm-hmm. So their top two receivers are really more of they're more like the Lions type of receivers, especially Kenny Golladay, higher-cut vertical guys, or the guys with the Chargers. That's the style of receiver they have. Therefore, that's going to be Gesicki, by the way, is like that as well. They're these long-bodied, high-cut guys. Adam Shaheen, their new tight end, I think, is the tallest tight end in the league. Isn't that? He's right up to 6'6", 278. He's the heaviest tight end, or one of them.
Yeah.
They're big guys. They're not little shifty guys. So that's how their passing game has to be designed. And then the question is, how does Chan Gailey do that, and how does he get to it? Chan Gailey, if he's going with the spread routes and spread personnel, he's just going to ask guys to win one-on-one with their bodies, and that's fine. That's not a bad way to play with Devontae Parker or Preston Williams, or especially Devontae Parker.
All right.
And I say him twice because I think he needs a certain level of freedom as a receiver.
Okay. I'll buy that. Defensive side of the ball, we see what they've done in the secondary. They had Byron Jones now. They're going to be good back there. I mean, look, it's Patriots style. They haven't invested big in edge rushers here. They did bring in Kyle Van Noy. I guess that's where your pass rush comes from. I just don't really see anyone else who really threatens here. This is going to have to be like fully manufactured.
Which is fine because that's the philosophy. And I have not had this conversation with anyone from the Dolphins or Patriots, so I don't know if this is exactly how they teach it, but it's evident on film. The way these guys, these Patriot and Dolphin players pass rush, they very often square up the blocker, which takes time, and then it's some kind of game from there. So you square up the blocker, and then you're running a stunt or some kind of twist. Your pass rushes are working hand-in-hand with other guys' pass rushes, and they're slow-developing pass rushes. So that's the philosophy. So you don't need – that's why you don't need the edge benders or the expensive Von Miller body-type guys. The smart technicians, the patient players like a Kyle Van Noy, that will get the job done. It'll be interesting to see how Shaq Lawson does in this scheme, because if Lawson is to have a successful NFL career, he's not twitchy, so it's going to have to be like this. He's going to have to really master this kind of pass rush, and I could see him maybe doing okay with that. However he's coached is a big deal. Same with Emmanuel Ogbah to a slightly lesser degree. These guys are not individual winners as pass rushers per se. But they can be excellent scheme players if it works together.
All right. With that, we go to the AFC East projections. Bills, 1.
Yep.
All right. Then it gets interesting. How far does New England fall? And just a reminder, Jets 6-2 finish, I believe. 6-3 finish last year. Miami 5-4 finish last year. They obviously went to New England and won in week 17. Do either of those teams leapfrog the Patriots?
It's entirely possible, and it's still hard to predict, isn't it? I am totally going to give into the Patriot mystique here, or at least acknowledge that some part of me has to be giving into that. I'm going to make you answer it first.
All right. Okay. I'll do it first. I'll go Buffalo, New England, Jets, then Miami in close one, but only one playoff team. No. Even with the three wild cards now, no. I mean, we talked plenty about wild cards in this league, and there are plenty of wild cards within the rosters of the division, but
yep.
No wild card teams. You know what I'm saying, Andy?
I do know. Yeah, kind of. Yeah. I would agree with that. Are the Patriots over under then on 8-8 for their record, or should we say over under on 8-7? So we have to can't push.
So you're basically setting it at 7.5.
Yeah, is that what I'm doing? Yeah, or, that's right. Yeah.
Okay.
Well, yeah. What will their record be?
Right on 8-8.
Okay. I could see him going 9-7, missing the playoffs, like you said, and then everybody's saying Bill Belichick deserves Coach of the Year.
Yeah.
Even though he probably deserves Coach of the Year 5 of the past 10 seasons, and nobody considers him because Coach of the Year has become like the award for best breakout coach is now who gets Coach of the Year, it seems like.
It either goes to Lovie Smith or whoever had like an 8-win turnaround. Bills Super Bowl contenders?
Contenders, yes.
Okay.
Not favorites. I would imagine they'd tell you that. This conference goes through Kansas City right now.
Yeah. Who would you pick as the second best team in the AFC right now? No, sorry. Third best team. Sorry, Ravens. I forgot about you for a second. Chiefs, Ravens, Bills third. I think I put Colts third and Bills fourth.
Ooh, interesting. That's a hard one. I think I'm with you on the Colts, by the way. And so maybe now we apologize to the Titans, who said, geez, what the world? We won almost all our games in the second half of last year.
Yeah.
We were on paper, on paper, it's probably Buffalo. And Tennessee's not to be dismissed. We haven't done the AFC South yet. We got to do the South AFC South soon.
Okay. Let's do it next week then. Most likely, this is another good. Most likely to win MVP here. There's no obvious answer. I mean, obviously, if the Patriots end up with 10 or 11 wins, does Cam get into that conversation? Otherwise, those two third-year quarterbacks. I don't think either of them you'd put among the favorites. But does Darnold or Josh Allen, which one is more likely to make the jump?
Let's pick a non-quarterback here. If ever there's a chance to do that.
Okay.
Well, I mean, listen to what we're saying here. Cam Newton is in a quarterback competition. So, he might win MVP if he can get on the field. Sam Darnold is trying to bounce back from a season where he had about 25 horrible mistakes, and he needs to get that number down to 5. Josh Allen was maybe 15. He needs to get the number down to 5. These guys don't belong in an MVP discussion just yet. Maybe one
day. Fair. Okay, who's Tre'Davious White?
As an MVP?
Yeah, who else would it be?
Who else
Stephon Gilmore.
Be,
yeah. Stephon Gilmore for
so
the...
So you're going defense. You're looking at the defense.
Yeah, I mean, Stephon Gilmore for the 3-13 Patriots.
I do think Gilmore at this point now is as valuable to New England as any defensive player is to their team, just about.
Okay. What offensive
player? He's more valuable to New England than White is to Buffalo, even though they're both first-tier cornerbacks, just because Buffalo's got more talent around White.
Stephon Diggs? Is that who you're going?
As, best offensive non-QB, like most likely to win MVP or what?
Yep.
I could go with that, I guess. I feel like I need to treat this as, like, who is the most valuable right now rather than trying to guess how this will shake out.
Okay. It's a tough division for this, though.
It is, because there aren't a lot of good players. That's what makes it tough. It's who is the most valuable non-quarterback on offense in the division? That's the discussion.
Yeah.
Edelman's in that conversation for sure. because the value then takes it. It becomes relevant to what you have around the guy, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Who, value to your team. That's what mm-hmm. the value would be.
Mm-hmm.
Diggs is in the conversation, but we haven't even seen Diggs in this offense yet, so it's hard to put your stake all the way into that one. Stake your claim on that one.
You're talking Le'Veon Bell. What do you think about Le'Veon Bell right now with an improved offensive line?
Well, we need how improved? I mean, we need to, they had a lot of room to get better.
What if
Mekhi Becton at left tackle now? McGovern at center. Udoga's back at right tackle. Winters is at right guard. I don't think that's an overwhelmingly intriguing right side of your line.
If they go from F plus to C plus on the offensive line this year,
Bell's probably an 1,100 yard back then.
Hmm.
Bell ran behind, and I am not at all saying that Le'Veon Bell, like the line made Le'Veon Bell in Pittsburgh, because I think Bell was as special as we made him out to be, and he's so unique. But, you know, he ran behind some really great blockers for a lot of years in Pittsburgh.
Yep.
And his style is dependent on blocking. The patience, you can't be patient and not depend on your blockers, because otherwise you're just standing there letting guys come tackle you. You, as a patient runner, you're more dependent on your blockers. So, you know, Bell's, even though he can create his own yards, because of the way he begins his runs, he's a type of running back like Derrick Henry, just for different reasons and certainly extremely different styles of runners, but he's dependent on the blocking with his style, at least for the early part of his run.
So no Le'Veon Bell for MVP?
I'm throwing my money away. The other thing is, Gase does not do a ton with the running back in the passing game, because Gase likes to use his receivers in multiple route combinations. It's just the style of their offense. So, no, I don't think it's Bell. You know, I think the guy you could argue for, and it's going to sound absurd, because I don't – well, does Miami have anyone real quick? I mean, maybe one of those wideouts just
– Devontae Parker, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Parker, I don't think, is refined enough to be considered a true number one receiver. Doesn't mean he won't have big numbers and all that, but – you're not building your offense around him the way you are around even an Edelman type. Mitch Morse at center for Buffalo, their run game is designed around interior O-line mobility, pin and pull, sweep runs, power, which moves the guard, not the center. But the point is, interior O-line mobility is the key to Baltimore or Buffalo's rushing attack, and probably therefore their entire offense, because they're not the type of offense that's going to throw 50 times in a game and win many of those. I had Mitch Morse first team all pro for that reason last mm-hmm. year. I would argue he is the most valuable offensive player non-quarterback in this division.
Yeah, more so than Edelman?
It's close. I would say yes.
Okay.
In part because I don't know what the Patriots' offense is now that they have a different quarterback in there. I do know this. If you take Mitch Morse off of the Bills' O-line, it's likely a different running game.
Okay. I like that we arrived at Mitch Morse as an MVP candidate by the end of the show. Last one, defensive player of the year. Gilmore obviously won it a year ago. But again, if the Patriots are going 1-15... can you give it to him again? So then does it go to Tre'Davious White?
Yeah, he'd be in that conversation. Even though, I think those safeties are the key to that secondary. You know, the guy who might sneak up on it at some point is Tremaine Edmonds. We didn't talk about those Buffalo linebackers, but they're a big-time duo. They're really good. They are fast. They have become very disciplined. Edmonds has matured gradually, and I would say quickly, is a fast ascension for him. And he's the type, he has the dynamic type. He's going to be a playmaker. He's got that Jamal Adams springiness to him a little bit. There's an explosive fluidity to how he plays.
I mean, the guy's 22 years old.
How long is that going to go on, though? I mean, like, how long are we going to keep stating his age? I know he was young when he came in, but he's now entering his third season.
22 is especially young.
He'll be 22
until May 2nd of next year when he turns 23.
So he's a pure 22 then.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. All right. I say you get one more year of doing that. And then when he's 23, he gets treated like the rest of the adults.
All right, until the Bills like draft like a 26-year-old, and then we'll spend all season talking about how much younger Tremaine Edmonds is. Oh,
do you remember who the last 26-year-old rookie was on defense to get drafted? I don't know if it's the last one, but it's the one I always think of. And to be fair, he was, I think he was a late 25 when he was drafted, but he was 26 at some point in his rookie season.
The Wisconsin guy was older this year. I'm blanking on his name, which is very sad. The linebacker who the Saints took.
Zach Bond,
yes. It's not him. He's not that old, is he?
No, it's not him. I'm wanting to get the number before I do the big reveal. I want to make sure I've got the numbers straight. So yeah, he was 25 as a rookie. He wasn't, and it was September 4th is his birthday, born 1978. His rookie year is 2003. He was 25. Terrence Newman, cornerback for the Cowboys at the time.
We're going way back there.
We are, but Newman played till he was 39. And so we're like, well, what a marvel, but you know, he would have been 35 if he'd come in at the league at kind of a more traditional age. Not that I'm taking anything at all away from him. He had a great career. Nice, very nice career.
Yeah.
But I always remember that as Terrence Newman. He came in so established, so old. That's what it was.
Danny Watkins came in as he was a 25-year-old?
Yeah, 26. That didn't last long either. Did not. Left as a 25-year-old, too.
Mm-hmm. All right, Andy.
Okay.
This is a wonderful show. We'll have more see. Bills talk.
I maybe went in too many directions and hemmed and hawed a lot. We're going to have to go back and listen to the tape on this one.
Listen to the tape, but just the quantity of Bills talk made it special. So once again, our special guest was Andy Benoit. If I could unveil that one more time before we go. Andy, thanks for joining us, and we'll call this just goodbye for now.
Okay.
The MMQB Monday Morning NFL Podcast is me, Gary Gramling, and special thanks once again to Andy Benoit for joining me for this one. We are produced by Shelby Royston, SI's executive producer of podcasts, and Scott Brody. Ben Eagle is director of editorial projects and product. Mark Bravick is emeritus editor of the MMQB. Andy Benoit is the founder of the MMQB NFL Podcast. Keep up with our entire lineup of podcasts 5 days a week by subscribing to the MMQB NFL Podcast for free on Apple Podcasts. And while you're there, please do us a favor and leave a rating and review. It really does help other people find the show, which is also available on Spotify, radio.com, Stitcher, SI.com, and wherever else you listen to podcasts.